ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मायं ददाति सापदन्तिकम्. वंशकौपाथरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयेव च पतितानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यप्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रियाद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदे घोर भक्तवृन्द. हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे. Greetings from Washington, D.C. I'm staying with Hari Kirtan. Actually, really interesting, there's a person in the building that old Washington building, quite nice, luxurious, I would say, who just has an apartment, very beautiful apartment, where he just, out of for free to people that he knows, he offers it as a guest room, a room for their guests. So I'm staying in that place, and then Hari Kirtan's apartment is upstairs. So what I've been preparing is what I'll share with you. I'm giving a lecture on yoga psychology. And two things actually inspired it many, many years ago. One, I was staying with my friend, Edwaita, Professor Edwin Bryant, and he was working on his translation of the Yoga Sutras and the six main commentaries. And I never really studied the Yoga Sutras, so I was used to stay in his house, and I would see the manuscript, and it was very interesting. And I understood at that time that what yoga is, according to one of the schools of Indian philosophy, I think the way it works is the Vedas are very, very vast. You know, spiritual life means making decisions. And a comprehensive philosophy gives you the tools to make any decision. In other words, everything is in relationship to spiritual life. You just have to make the right decision in relationship to it. So there's information in the Vedas about health, about social life, and military, all aspects of human form of life, including Upanishadic, Ganic type things, and there's so many things are there. And including particular means or ways of self-realization, because ultimately the world has a theme, and the theme is getting out of the world, basically. That's the ultimate theme. That's the goal. The goal is to be ultimately situated in the self. So there's various philosophies that emphasize different ways to do it. For example, Sankhya is philosophical analysis. Vedanta is scriptural analysis. Nyaya is logic. Mimamsa, I'm not quite sure. I know it deals with rituals and hermeneutics. Visheshika is atomism, maybe a more materialistic scientific view. And then there is yoga, and yoga is psychology, or the study of the mind. So it's not that there was a separate yoga section, but it dealt with it throughout the Vedas. And what Patanjali did was collect that information and put it in the form of a sutra, summarize the whole school and make a school of psychology or the mind. And they put it all in one place and they organize it very systematically and logically. And then the basic core philosophical points are codified so that when you learn from a teacher, those aphorisms, those codes are unpacked. So you learn a whole category of that school and you can memorize it by the codes, which now you're able to unpack. I mean, I studied the Yoga Sutras and I saw how that worked. That was one thing. It had fascinating kind of comprehensive analysis of how the mind works. And at the same time, someone asked me, is there therapy in the Vedas? And I immediately thought that interesting question. I thought that after studying it, it was a profound analysis of how the mind can be positively transformed. A profound analysis that, in my understanding, formed basically a paradigm which would be the template for how any psychological system would work. If anybody had a system of psychology that transformed the mind, you could explain it in terms of the basic yogic principles. So I summed it up in basic principles, and the template was something like this, that the first thing is very important. The mind is malleable. And we see it. It's constantly reshaping its modes very quickly, basically. Something can immediately put you into passion. Something can immediately put you into ignorance. Certain things inspire goodness. And, you know, according to our philosophy, yoga philosophy, Gita philosophy, is there are subtle strands of matter composing the world, both gross and subtle, called modes. And they allow you to conduct different types of activities and thoughts. And that's basically goodness, passion, and ignorance, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And, of course, like primary colors, they mix together. And according to the mode or shape of the mind, that is how you will feel. It's a simple psychology. It's very profound. If the mind is molded to ignorance, you'll be lethargic and depressed. And if the mind is molded to passion, you'll have intense desires, yearnings, and anxiety. And when the mind is molded to goodness, you'll have your perception will be clear and you'll be peaceful. And it's very, very profound. This is the template. This is how things work. So the yoga psychology would be to understand what are those things that influence the shape of the mind. And by controlling those things, you can control your psychological state. And I listed three. One is your karma, one of your actions, and one is your environment. And then there's a science of how the environment affects the consciousness, which is very profound. There's a science how your actions affect the consciousness, which is very profound. And there's a way in which your karma and your reaction to it affects the mode of the mind. So, by understanding that, you have tools to actually control the mind. You have tools to control the mind. Now, getting back to the question, is there therapy of the Vedas? And then I'll go over a summary about this. There wasn't specialists, basically, maybe exorcists, but there weren't specialists because the foundations of mental health were built within the society in terms of the family structure. I don't know what percentage, but most mental problems can be related to the nurturing and protection that one has when they grow up. So in a society where there was great effort to have compatible relationships, where there was great effort to have the nurturing influences very prominent in a child's life, where there was inbuilt structures that prevented people from acting whimsically and fostered commitment, and where there was a tradition of knowledge and wisdom within the home, there wasn't a need for separate therapy. You know, now I know, like in different countries, I just go to South America, like Argentina, every other person's a psychologist. In America, so many people say, what does that say about the society? It was more preventative than curative, if that's the right word. I'm not sure it is. And more preventative. I remember one example where someone had a particular service, and they had grown up in America, and they had some deformity, and I can imagine what that does to the consciousness in a place where America, where the prime psychology is I am successful. And it's a psychology built on image. That's the basic psychology of America, is image. That's why Americans are so good at promotion, they're so good at advertising. Because when you have your vision and you have your self-ideal as I am successful, then it's all about how people perceive you. If you have your self-ideal, I am righteous, then it's not about being successful or not about being powerful. It's about being the right doing the right thing. So I can imagine growing up in that culture, how much it affected the mind. So anyway, but the person had a service that was lauded. But then when he got older and he slipped and he hurt himself, he couldn't do the service. And then somehow or other, he just completely unraveled to the point of being schizophrenic and not eating and not sleeping and not bathing. And not, and people kept on coming in trying to preach to him. And I kept on telling the people, it's not the philosophy. He knows the philosophy. It's not the philosophy. And then eventually I helped with an intervention from a friend of mine in America who's a PhD in psychology, a God brother. And he told them what to do. They had no understanding. They somehow got him help. He got a little medicine, a little counseling. Very quickly he was better. Very quickly. So I went to the Indian person who was in charge and I said, how come you didn't do anything? He was depressed. And the person said, well, he said, I heard there was depression, but I never really knew it. I heard that was in Bollywood or something, but he had no frame of reference for depression. And then I understood this person who was my age, father died. They were still taking care of the mother. There was so much affection. And those nurturing influences, they put in so much positive worth within one's consciousness and so much optimism within one's consciousness that in difficult circumstances, the mind doesn't unravel. Rather, you can draw on those impressions within the consciousness. And what to speak that overactive minds and anxiety, as far as I can see, it's when a child doesn't grow up in a stable environment. And a stable environment is a world that the child enters that is fair and loving, not a world that a child creates by their own desires. When you let a child create the world by his own desires, and when you don't have a strong community and a strong tradition and a strong family, and the family is nuclear, and then the child is there, he's the center of attention. And like anything else in the material world, the samskaras are there, the child tries for control, he learns how to control. The parents, and every day the world is a different environment for the child. So he doesn't grow up in a stable world, and it makes the mind overactive. And then the child, when he grows up, he's subject to anxiety attacks. So, I mean, the answer was there therapy in the Vedas? There weren't therapists. There were teachers, there were people with knowledge, there were people with wisdom. But these psychological aberrations were not pronounced because they are a result of dysfunction. And the society was quite functional. Even in terms of relationships, they were determined by caste, commonality, by astrology. So generally, people very much shared the same ideals. Even that there wasn't, and there was decision-making processes in society rather than fighting it out. There was elders and so many things. Anyway, so these different factors, they powerfully affect the mind. The first one is karma. You know, there was Shastra. And people were taught what the world moving around them means and how to respond to it in a way that doesn't create trauma and unhealthy impressions within the consciousness, because they can understand what karma is and how things are a destiny is the language of God, and things are coming to us for our own purification. So there's a lot of help in how to see things and respond to things so that they don't put heavy, traumatic, irrational impulses within the consciousness. And there's also a structure to deal with one's prarabdha karma, the nature one had. And a society that would engage that in meaningful work to give one satisfaction. So, and then the environment, people knew that there was a side, the environment is the same shapes that are subtle within our mind, those same shapes are within the environment. For example, cleanliness is the object of sight and the mode of goodness. If things are kept clean, then they impact the consciousness and elevate the consciousness. But it's like that with all the objects of the senses. Therefore, it was called the Brahminical culture. It doesn't mean that everyone was a Brahmin, but it means the society was organized in terms of its culture, its relationships, its music, its art, to impact the consciousness in a favorable way. Prabhupada called the city sometimes, in one purport, dungeons of demons. Describe all the rich people, they live, they have beautiful country homes. So there was an aesthetic. If you look at the Bhagavatam and read what Dwarka was like, the environment was so beautiful and clean and impacting the consciousness, the sights, the sounds, the fragrances. Everything was elevating the consciousness, the music. Music is also in different modes. And music in the mode of goodness will degrade your consciousness. Music in the mode of passion will increase your attachments and anxieties. And music in the mode of goodness, the right rags, the right melodies, the right tals, the right rhythms, they will elevate the consciousness. And in terms of the food you eat, which is so important, the culture of food is very important for the consciousness. Even when we go to my friend Sridhar in the woods, the gardens of Vrindavan, just that culture where people don't have a refrigerator and they have people cooking with love every meal, and they cook what people can eat. You eat things that are fresh, things that are left over in the mode of ignorance. You have things that are fresh, cooked in the right way, served with love, cooked with love. The fact of a mother at home is so important. If you get my Monday morning greetings, I wrote an article called A Fifth Commandment Solution to a Second Amendment Problem, where I talked about the problem of gun violence. And not discounting that this is an issue that has to be discussed, the proliferation of guns in America. But the real problem is the broken families. The father and mother divorced, not at home, and the effect it has on their children, especially the boys. When the father is distant or abusive, testosterone, I read one article, it can be the most constructive or destructive force in the world. So the the family structure, and then the way that the actions, the way the actions affect the consciousness. We have a myriad of choices to make in this world. And what Dharma is the science of the correct choice according to the circumstance. And the circumstance depends on the decision you have to make and also who you are. One man's food is another man's poison. Most important thing in society is mentors. Because we have decisions, and the right decision is the one that will elevate your consciousness, move your consciousness to a higher level of perception and contentment. And it may not always be the decision that dictates or is dictated by immediate satisfaction. So Dharma, there's so many decisions. What is the correct one? The correct one may be attachment for a monk or a brahmachari who material desires, sex desires too strong. Then the decision that will elevate his consciousness is to get married and raise a family. And for another person, the decision that will elevate his consciousness is to renounce family. But every situation is very subtle. So there was a society and a culture, obviously, psychology. What's the goal of psychology? Obviously, it's happiness. Not pleasure, it's happiness. And happiness comes from a consciousness that's molded to a higher level of perception, and therefore a higher level of contentment. And also the protection of the children. You know, the education. Everything was focused on good progeny, good source. Child is the father of man. In the modern world, they're creating very unstable people. I heard one psychologist, he discussed what happened is, he said one of the most healthy things, he said, for children is to play, to learn, to, you know, to negotiate without their parents the various trials to a reasonable extent, and the reasonable, there's trials and conflicts in the world. It's just like when I grew up, from the earliest age I can remember, you go out in the street and you go to your friend and you get beat up and you cry. But the psychologist described, and he studied this, that when children began to become, when they were kidnapped and abused and all these Amber Alerts and things like that, parents became very, very concerned. And now there had to be play dates and everything had to be supervised. There always had to be an adult around. And the children wouldn't face conflict. And therefore you have situations where safe spaces, trigger warnings in school, when the very fact that all psychological systems say that if to overcome your trauma, there has to be a reasonable opportunity to confront them, not to just shelter you from them. You never get over your traumas. So the whole society, and when children were young, the system, the child also, when the child was born, he grew up into this, to joint families. And what that would mean is, even though there were so many people to give the children affection, he can never assume the role of dictating the environment. He lived in a joint world dictated basically by some tradition and culture. See, he couldn't control the environment, but at the same time, he wasn't neglected. He'd get maximum affection. And then the culture of faith is so important, the culture of obedience. When a child is young, his booty or his intelligence is not highly developed. And therefore, he has to be protected because he cannot digest rationally the experiences of the environment. So they would create trauma. So the children were protected. If the child has a bad experience, a girl has a bad experience with the father, then she can get the mindset that all men are bad. No, all men are not bad. I had a bad experience, but men in general are not bad. That's the intelligence, not just the impulse. So the children were protected, in one sense, reasonably from traumas, and they were obedient to their parents, so their parents' booty judgment would guide them properly, and there was a culture of booty or intelligence. They would be guided properly and protected and educated. And because of that obedience, as the child matured, as he was educated, as he would develop his own intelligence, the parents would gradually shift the obedience from to themselves to the child's own intelligence. And at age-appropriate levels, the child would get more and more responsibility. In fact, at a very early age, the child would be encouraged to take initiative, run family businesses, work in the house, do their chores. So it was very healthy. At the same time, their intelligence was developed. And what the Buddha does is it takes your experiences, even if they're difficult, and can make a proper judgment based to Shastra so that they don't cause trauma. You can digest it, even in a very difficult circumstance. If your intelligence is very powerful, you may have been mistreated, etc., and you understand the law of karma, you understand destiny is the language of God, you understand so many things, so that same trauma, that same difficulty doesn't put an unhealthy impression in your manas, your mind, to force you to see things irrationally and respond to them irrationally in an unhealthy way. So you had that level of ability. Anyway, I'm asked to speak something on this. I haven't spoke on this subject for a while. I'll also talk about, because it's so profound, that knowledge of the Yoga Sutras on how habits are formed and what are addictions. It analyzes and categorizes the experiences people have, so you know exactly how things are caused, and therefore you know exactly what the remedy is. So I'll also teach that. Let me see what time it is. And then, of course, ultimately, the society was aimed at transcendence. Because no matter how peaceful and orderly and healthy the mind is, still one's world is temporary and to some extent superficial if not connected to God. And therefore there was always a philosophy of there was a goal. The goal was not family life, the goal was not mental stability, but they were the means for something greater, which was self-realization, which is the ultimate transformation of the mind. Just like ourselves, there is a spiritual practice, and the spiritual practice, of course, our spiritual practice, Chaito, Dharpana, and Marjanam, when we chant the holy name, we have relations with the holy name. It not only steadies the mind, it's so important to have good sadhana and substantial sadhana, especially japa in the morning. I was at the Bhakti Center. I was enjoying the whole program from the Mangal Arati to the greeting of the deities to the Guru Puja. But especially japa is such an opportunity to try to meditate and focus on an object of meditation, which is God and sound. And I have that own experience. Of course, it's easier when I'm in India, and it's like every single day is the same thing. Somehow I lost track of my last point. Just give me a second. Yeah, so the sadhana, that concentration over a period of time without interruption in the right mood, it's so powerful. Meditation itself to mold the mind to a higher level of perception and contentment. So you enter into your day in a less impulsive state and a more perceptive state so that you can make more, you can have a healthier perception and make more beneficial decisions. That's so important. It's so important to have that. And ultimately, in our meditation, the object of our meditation is not just the prop, it's the divine in sound. So we're not just steadying the mind, we're bringing something into the mind. I mean, the psychology of bhakti is very, very interesting. Most psychology is inside out, outside in. You're trying to change the world to impact your consciousness. Bhakti deals directly with the transformation of the consciousness, especially when you do sadhana. So that's what I have to say. If anybody wants to have any questions, they're welcome to ask. I really do hope I get back to the Bhagavatam. It's just the traveling. I need to sit in one place and organize. I'll be upstate now for about 10 days, and that's going to be really wonderful.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Gail, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Can you just repeat, do you remember the very last line you said? Can you repeat that about circumstances? You know, most practices, they work on the, I don't know, outside in, inside outside.
Let me see if I can read that directly from my paper. Okay, one second.
Yes.
Take me a second. You got my message from Stephanie?
Oh, it was.
Very
sweet. Yes, I did.
You know, I have such a good setup here with Hari Kirtan. Has a beautiful apartment. I have this, I would say, luxurious, this luxurious kind of guest room. But she's here every day, you know, doing service.
Nice.
Yeah. She's here right now, actually, not in my room, but doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I wrote. In this sense, the process of bhakti yoga works through the transformation of the material mind as other processes do. Sri Chaitanya is certainly one of the most prominent proponents of the Bhakti tradition, thus declares the first verse of his seminal composition, Shikshastakam, Chaito Dharpana Marjanam, that chanting cleanses Marjanam, the mind, Chaita, which is like a mirror, Dharpanam. In ways, this is a classic yoga description of attaining samadhi, where the material mind of the embodied soul regains its pure condition, where the soul can be reflected on without distortion, the stage before one transcends the corporal sphere altogether. Of course, how the mind recovers its pure condition on the path of bhakti and how it does in other processes also quite different. On the path of bhakti, real devotion, selfless devotion is not just a mental or physical activity, but an expression of the soul. Thus, unlike other paths, which work, so to speak, from the outside in, that is, they deal directly with the transformation of a mind as a way to achieve pure inner awareness, bhakti is the opposite. Bhakti is first arousing of the soul with devotion that then purifies the mind. In other words, as consciousness flows from the sheath of the conditioned soul to animate it, including the mind, when that consciousness is awakened to its true nature of selfless devotion, the mind is gradually transformed to more and more conducive states of higher realization. This transformation thus happens simultaneously as bhakti imbues the soul with devotion. Quote, devotion, direct experience of the Supreme Lord, and detachment from other things, these three occur simultaneously for one who has taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the same way that pleasure, nourishment, and relief from hunger comes simultaneously, increasingly, with each bite for a person engaged in eating. Bhagavatam 11.142. Obviously, the degree to which bhakti inspires the soul and transforms the mind depends on the purity of our practice and our level of devotion. Real transformative devotion is thus rag bhakti, where attachment, rag to the Lord, not just obligation and duty, is the motivating force of our action. Bhakti, action done with pure love for God, is thus a powerful transformative agent as it invokes grace, stirs the soul, and flows naturally away from egoism and exploitation, the core obstacles to yoga. In Bhagavad Gita, it is thus deemed the best of transformative paths. Okay, that was it,
it was just that, you know, in bhakti yoga, it seems like our approach is to, like, engage the sheath to awaken the consciousness instead of the other way around. We engage the mind and the senses in devotional practices in order to awaken the soul. So it seems like it is also in bhakti yoga, working from the outside in.
I said that, but there's also this other element, that when you're focusing on God, it stirs the soul.
Uh-huh. So it's both. And bhakti yoga is both.
Yeah. I think I wrote that here. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Both.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Gail.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna.
Hi, both. Chaitanya Priya.
I am so pleased to hear you talk about the subject, because this is what I am working with. And I think I'd like to hear fully when you're going to speak about it or where it'll be available to hear.
Well, go on my website, wavesofdevotion.com. Go to the section on essays and look at yoga psychology. I wrote it down completely. Okay?
Okay,
it's a very long article. Okay, thank you, Sri Tanya Kriya.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anybody else say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, Tota Gopinath here. Good to hear from you.
Tota, Hare Bo, you have a big program today, huh? There's a
sure
big
do.
Program, right? Okay,
yeah.
Great. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Gumaraj. This is Kishori and Priya.
Hi, Bo. Good. Very nice. Anybody else?